Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Damon Moglen of Greenpeace, who spells out why his group cannot support the Waxman-Markey climate legislation that recently won approval in the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Peter Hart of the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who explains why he believes the New York Times acted as a propagandist for a Pentagon report on former Guantanamo detainees returning to terrorism. And Rich Forer of the Coalition to Stop $30 billion to Israel, who talks about his group's New Mexico billboard campaign and how his views as a Jewish American about Israel have evolved. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the spring of 1968, French workers went on strike at an aviation plant to protest a cut in hours and wages. A few weeks later, they locked themselves and the boss inside the plant and were soon joined by leftist students during the spring uprising. More than 40 years later, a new wave of boss nappings has swept through France. Workers facing layoffs from the global recession have detained executives of Sony France and 3M until management agreed to concessions. The economic crisis has also triggered a resurgence of direct action. French President Nicolas Sarkozy has condemned these boss nappings as illegal, but the government has not yet prosecuted the workers involved in the incidents. French political analysts say this wave of worker direct action is very localized and about survival with no long-term political agenda, in contrast with the action of workers and students in the late 1960s and early 1970s. More in tune with the spirit of 1968 are wild picnics staged by leftists in supermarkets. Activists take food off the shelves and offer it for free to customers until they get kicked out by security. The events are staged to protest high food prices by groups affiliated with the Anti-Capitalist Party, a rising force in the French political left. The Guardian newspaper reports Dubai, the center of the Middle East construction boom, fueled by high oil prices, has experienced the world's biggest crash in real estate prices so far in 2009. Housing prices there dropped 40% during the first quarter of 2009. Singapore, buckling under the collapse of exports to the United States and Europe, saw housing prices fall 16% during the first quarter. Yet, housing prices rose in other major markets like Finland, Thailand, Israel, and Switzerland. Over the last year, housing prices fell in Britain 17%, pushing the United Kingdom into recession and endangering the political future of Labour Party Prime Minister Gordon Brown. In the United States, prices in the top 20 metro markets fell 19% in March compared with a year earlier. The Mortgage Bankers Association found that 12% of all homeowners were behind in their mortgage payments or in the process of foreclosure. In the midst of the housing booms and busts, Switzerland has remained a sea of stability. Prices rose an average of 1.5% over the last 20 years, but increased over 5% in 2008. Facing mounting budget deficits, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has opened the door to a full public debate over legalizing and taxing marijuana. Advocates of legalization, such as California Assemblyman Tom Amiano of San Francisco, say taxing marijuana, like alcohol, could boost state revenue by $1.3 billion a year. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the state already collects $18 million from medical marijuana sales. A recent national poll by Zogby International showed a narrow majority of support for legalizing, regulating, and taxing marijuana. In March, President Obama squashed hopes for national marijuana reform when he told an online town meeting that legalizing and taxing marijuana would be bad for the economy. Jack Cole of the drug reform group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition countered, "It would be an enormous economic stimulus if we stopped wasting so much money arresting and locking up people for non-violent drug offenses." Still, the California Police Chiefs Association opposes drug reform or moves towards legalization. In February, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder halted raids of medical marijuana centers. the move was seen by drug reform advocates as a growing sign of tolerance in the Obama administration for changes in state-specific marijuana laws. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Efforts over the past 8 years to pass legislation to reduce the industrial greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change were blocked by the Bush administration, which often characterized global warming as a myth. The White House, under Mr. Bush, was caught censoring scientific papers and deleting information from government websites that contradicted the corporate conservative view that human activity has nothing to do with the warming of the planet. In stark contrast to Mr. Bush and his GOP opponent, John McCain, Barack Obama campaigned for the presidency by promising to fight the coal, gas, and oil industries to implement new policies that would control greenhouse gases. With Congress and the White House firmly in Democratic hands after the 2008 election, many environmental activists were optimistic that the nation's failure to address global warming would soon change. After months of debate, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, led by Democratic Representatives Waxman and Markey, approved carbon cap and trade legislation on May 21st. The American Clean Energy and Security Act, as it's called, would require a 17% reduction of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 levels by 2030 and an 83% decrease by 2050. While the bill has the backing of corporations like Alcoa, Duke Energy and GE, and qualified support from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Sierra Club, environmental groups Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth have denounced the measure as a sellout to big business. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Damon Moglen, Greenpeace Global Warming Campaign Director, who explains why his group can't support the Waxman-Markey climate legislation.
The international scientific community has really pretty much reached a consensus on how serious the various kinds of pollution are that are causing global warming. And the international science, scientists in a panel called the IPCC, has basically issued a kind of declaration that what we need to be doing is we need to be decreasing these greenhouse gas pollution by 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. And instead, this piece of legislation is only calling for a reduction of about 4% as compared with this 25 to 40%. And those are huge differences. So Greenpeace and many other environmental organizations, both here in the United States and abroad, feel that, unfortunately, we're getting the science wrong in this bill. And we have to begin from the science. We have to know what we're trying to accomplish and not be playing politics with these numbers. And unfortunately, right now, the bill is really being led by politics and not by the science of global warming and the utter need that we have to significantly reduce these greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, I know one of the other major controversies in this version of the bill passed by the Energy and Commerce Committee is the fact that instead of auctioning off these carbon shares or whatever they're called, that these units would be given away to many industries as a result of a lot of the pressure they exerted on the legislators.
That's right. That's right. I mean, this is a terrible giveaway, and it really undermines the entire idea behind this. The idea when you talk about cap and trade is that you're supposed to cap your emissions, and then you're supposed to force the polluters to pay for their pollution, with the idea that by paying, you're going to make it hard on them to continue to pollute, and you're going to make it strongly encouraged on them to move from dirty production to clean and renewable energy production. But what's being introduced into this bill completely undercuts that idea, which is that the dirty industries have lobbied very aggressively and at very great cost, and they are saying, no, we want you to give us these permits for free. We don't want to have an auction where all that money could be raised, which in turn the federal government could be using to pay money for more renewable and more clean energy, and in turn be helping ratepayers to underwrite any increases in costs. But instead, we're just going to give the polluters a get-out-of-jail-free card, and they're going to go on polluting with these permits issued by the government. And that's got it completely wrong.
Damon, tell our listeners a bit about how Washington works, in particular how these energy company and other lobbyists are exerting a lot of pressure on these legislators, not only on this Energy and Commerce Committee, but the entire House and Senate, to ensure that this bill serves their interests.
Well, I think that this is a classic and really quite sad Washington, D.C. story. We have a situation in which some really terrific members of Congress have been trying to lead us on this bill. Mr. Markey and Mr. Waxman are both real leaders in the House of Representatives on environmental policy making. And industry has just really used their lobbying efforts and their money to leverage very, very aggressively in this committee to get what they want. And unfortunately, there have been other members who have been very ready to do the work of the coal industry, the oil and the gas industries, and they have really radically subverted this bill. A bill that set out to place good targets, to, as you were saying, make it expensive for industry, to really create a renewable energy standard that was going to create effective renewable energy, and also to really get a grip on dirty industry in this country. Issue after issue, time after time in the bill, things have been undercut. So we have, for example, a really ludicrous situation in which, as many of your listeners know, burning coal is a really dirty and terribly pollutive undertaking right now and is one of the major contributors to greenhouse gas production. And yet, this bill goes from basically trying to really limit the coal industry and their dirty activities to actually, over the lifetime of this bill, we might be talking about anything up to $150 billion in subsidies and write-offs for the coal industry. And if that's not a perfect example of the bill going wrong and the lobbyists getting their way, I don't know what it is.
That was Damon Moglen, Greenpeace Global Warming Campaign Director. Contact Greenpeace by calling area code 202-462-1177 or visit their website at greenpeace.org. On May 20th, the U.S. Senate voted 90-6 to deny President Obama the $80 million he requested to close America's Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and to bar the transfer of detainees held there to the United States and its territories. Upon taking office, Mr. Obama pledged to close the Guantanamo facility by January 2010. Both Democrats and Republicans were critical of the White House for not presenting a detailed plan for what will be done with the 240 Guantanamo prisoners. In the debate that followed, legislators and commentators expressed concern over the threat posed by these detainees, virtually all of whom are accused by the U.S. government of engaging in terrorist activities. The day after the Senate vote, the New York Times published a front-page article titled, "One in Seven Free Detainees Rejoins Fight," report finds, confirming the fears of many in Congress and around the nation that closing Guantanamo would have grave consequences. However, as the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, pointed out, the story was based on an unsubstantiated Pentagon report leaked to the paper, which failed to present evidence for its findings. The Times reporter for this story, Elizabeth Buemiller, did not provide readers background on the many challenges made to the findings of similar Pentagon studies, which were widely disputed. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with FAIR, who explains why he believes the New York Times was acting as a propaganda arm of the Pentagon for its failure to substantiate the Pentagon's dubious assertions.
The New York Times story was very similar to reporting that's been done on earlier Pentagon reports of this nature. I think this is maybe the fifth or sixth time the Pentagon has come out with new numbers to try to prove that Guantanamo detainees pose a unique threat to the war on terror. So this particular piece came, front-page piece, on, as you said, May 21st, one in seven freed detainees rejoins fight, report finds. It's written by Elizabeth Buemiller, who was the Times correspondent covering George W. Bush for part of his presidency and now is the Pentagon correspondent. And the Pentagon leaked this, or someone at the Pentagon leaked this report to the Times in order to get that front page billing. Right around the same time Obama and Cheney were giving what the media were calling dueling speeches on terror policy. And that 1 in 7 number became the talk of cable news that day and for the next couple of days. It's intended to tell us that Guantanamo detainees are unusually radicalized, unusually dangerous, and if let go, as you say, they would pose this threat to either U.S. interests at home or abroad. So that was the point that the Pentagon was trying to make, and I think the New York Times, by really sort of mishandling this story, they gave the Pentagon exactly the kind of rollout for this that they wanted, so that the backdrop to that Obama speech was Guantanamo is still filled with dangerous places, and no matter what he says about closing it, it's going to be difficult and potentially dangerous to Americans.
In terms of the journalism there at the New York Times, what kinds of fact checks were done here to this leak, which, as you said, came initially from the Pentagon itself?
Yeah, it looks like, you know, because the Pentagon released this report a couple days afterwards, so the jump that the Times got on the news was minimal. This was really done for the Pentagon's benefit. It wasn't because the Times got a unique perspective on this. And what I think what you would fail the Times for is the lesson is sort of in the lead. The two claims that are made right in the headline, 1 in 7 freed detainees rejoins fight. So you have two facts laid out, this 1 in 7 number and rejoining the fight. And two of these things are very problematic. When you broke down the numbers that were available from the Pentagon, this 1 in 7 number looks to be wildly exaggerated. It's hard to tell exactly how exaggerated because they don't name most of the detainees that they're talking about. Most of them cannot be named because they're apparently too dangerous. The second problem with the story is that when you're saying somebody rejoined the fight in the war on terror, you're saying that they were terrorists to begin with. And the interesting thing about this is that the author of the piece, Elizabeth Buemiller, went on television the day the Times printed it and sort of walked it back, saying, you know, rejoins might not be the right language to use in a piece like this because we don't know if these people were terrorists in the first place, which is why the Times went on to change the headline on their website and change some of the language in the actual report. As we pointed out, the Times seemed to acknowledge in the very beginning of the article that this was going to have political impact, and then by the way they reported it, they were sure to give it exactly the political impact that people on the right and at the Pentagon wanted it to have.
What I get from this leak, the underside of the story, that there are people at the Pentagon who are trying to undermine Obama's policy of closing Guantanamo, is that something that is certainly hidden here someplace?
You have to suspect that that's what's going on, at least that's part of it. And they knew, you know, we are not so naive to not understand the political dynamic here, that getting something on the front page of the New York Times in that right corner means that it's going to have unusual impact in the rest of the media, which is exactly what this story had, which is exactly the tactic from the run-up to the Iraq War, for example. You leak something to the New York Times, and then you have people who can go out and say, look, the New York Times is reporting today that X, Y, and Z. So I think it's a good guess that there were people inside the Pentagon who wanted these numbers out. The Times report and some of the other reports suggested that there were people who had mixed rationales for this, that there were some people who thought sitting on the numbers looked bad, and then there were other people who thought getting the numbers out is going to make this look good. Interestingly, a couple days after this was, almost a week, actually a little more than a week after this story ran, there was an op-ed co-authored by Peter Bergen, who's a terrorism expert and journalist, and the point of the op-ed in the New York Times was to say that most of the terror threats that are listed in this Pentagon report are vague, and a good number of them don't have anything to do with the United States. As he pointed out, something like 11 men named in this report are Saudis who are on a most wanted list put out by the Saudi kingdom. 9 of them are on that most wanted list because they're anti-royalists in Saudi Arabia. So these are not necessarily people who pose a threat to the United States or who are engaged in any activity that you could consider against U.S. Policy or targeting U.S. military personnel. So it's a really vague Pentagon report. They've all been vague, and this one is no different. The curious thing is to look at the New York Times and where they put this and the effect that it had. And, you know, when you look at all that and you add it all up, you suspect, as you say, that there are people at the Pentagon who really wanted this out.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. FAIR's report, New York Times Pentagon Propaganda, Misleading Report on Guantanamo and Terrorism, can be read online at FAIR.org. For more information, call their office at area code 212-633-6700. Beginning in April, a group opposing U.S. military aid to Israel began running the following message on 10 billboards around Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tell Congress, stop killing children. No more military aid to Israel. The billboards featured images of an Israeli tank on one side and a young Palestinian girl on the other side. The billboards were sponsored by the Coalition to Stop $30 billion to Israel in the wake of Israel's invasion of Gaza, in which 1,400 Palestinians were killed, including hundreds of children. The contract between Lamar Outdoor Advertising and the Coalition was for 8 weeks, but the billboards were taken down after 3 weeks due to pressure on the company from pro-Israel groups. However, after negotiating a new message, the billboards were to go back up in early June. The new message did not mention killing children, but says, tell Congress, stop giving weapons to Israel with our tax dollars. But then the corporate office of Lamar rescinded the agreement after receiving more negative phone calls. One of the coalition members responsible for the billboards is Rich Forer, a Jewish American who was formerly a member of AIPAC, the extremely influential American-Israel Political Action Committee that has long provided uncritical support to the Israeli government's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Forer about how his views about Israel have evolved, why he joined AIPAC, and why he left.
We have gotten a surprising response, at least I'm surprised. Within a few days of putting up the billboards, we got responses from as far away as Mombasa, Kenya. And we got letters, mostly positive support from people all over the country. There have been a couple emails where we're being called anti-Semitic or where we're being told that, you know, Israel's tried to do everything, but the Arabs or the Palestinians are the ones who are at fault for there not being a peace. Then I recently was in a dialogue with a guy who's probably well-meaning. You know, what most people do is, to defend their beliefs, is they find sources that reinforce their beliefs rather than just look for the facts in an unbiased way. So this guy had been researching the subject, but his method of research was to use The Case for Israel by Alan Dershowitz, which supported his pre-existing beliefs, and to use an organization called FLAME. It's a very pro-Israeli group. FLAME stands for Facts and Logic About the Middle East. And I checked them out, and here's one of the things that FLAME says, quote, a homeland for Arab Palestinians? Of course they deserve one. They have such a country. It's Jordan. That's one quote. Here's another one. Their founder said this, quote, all Arab Muslims may not be a bunch of fanatics, but I've never met one who isn't, end of quote. Basically, I think both men are fairly reasonable men, but to me the problem is that both men are so identified with their beliefs and images that emanate from their Jewish identity that they are unable to see with clarity and compassion. That's where I'm coming from, that as long as you're tied to an individual identity, anything that falls out the boundaries that fit in comfortably within that identity is going to be seen as a threat. And because of the indoctrination that we all have, and the indoctrination, in their case, that Jews receive growing up, and the belief that the Jewish world is at the mercy of the rest of the world, and that the Arab world is anti-Semitic and has pretty much the same goals as Hitler, it creates a great deal of fear, and that creates confusion. And so, therefore, they are unable to see the other as a human being. They see the other as
Rich Bohr, why did you join AIPAC?
I joined AIPAC because I was so upset when Hezbollah invaded northern Israel and killed a couple Israeli soldiers and kidnapped a couple. I was so upset by it that I realized, it's, at least in that state of mind, it came to me that there was just no hope of peace and that the Arab world was always going to attempt to kill Jews.
And why did you leave AIPAC?
The reason I left AIPAC is because I had an argument with a couple friends who were more pro-Palestinian. I should say they were pro-human rights. And being pro-human rights, they were upset what they saw as Israel's disproportionate response in destroying so much of Lebanon. And they didn't seem to be sensitive to my point of view, and that made me even less sensitive to their point of view. But just by coincidence, after having my debates with these two that only made me more resistant, I got a phone call from a childhood friend who is Jewish. Now, he's someone who had studied this issue for years, and he was not particularly in favor of one side or the other. And I started complaining to him about how hateful the Arab world was towards Israel and towards the Jews. And we had like a three-hour conversation. And every once in a while he would interrupt me and say, Richie, that's wrong, that's wrong. But he never showed any judgment or criticism of what I was saying. He was completely neutral as to what I was saying and accepted whatever I said. If he disagreed with it, he disagreed with it in a way that did not make me feel like he was criticizing me. And as a result, that allowed me enough space to say to myself, I should check this out for myself. What happened was, after reading about Israel's use of lethal force in situations where there was no threat of bodily harm, Israel's collective punishment of large groups of Palestinian people, Israel's stealing of water resources from the Palestinians, I was getting more and more upset. And at a certain point, I realized that what he was saying was true. And I went through a series of emotions. I went through anger at Israel for treating another people this way. And then I became angry at myself for having ignored this issue for so many years and having defended Israel's punitive actions towards the Palestinians for so many years. And then I went through shame and embarrassment at my own lack of integrity. Then finally, I felt sorrow for the Palestinian people and what they had suffered for over 60 years.
That was Richard Forer of the Coalition to Stop $30 Billion to Israel. For more information, visit the group's website at stop30billion.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.